This is a download from the Jefferson Society at the University of Virginia. On November 2, 2007, the Society heard from John Miller, a former U.S. ambassador at large, on modern-day slavery. He's introduced by Society Vice President Amro Natty.
Hello, Society. Thank you for being out here at one of our speaker series events. I'll keep my introduction brief and, as always, thank the Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies Office for being our chief partner this semester of the speaker series. And also thanks to Sean Tubbs for assisting us in podcasting before these events. Our speaker for this evening is Ambassador John Miller. John Miller is a former U.S. Ambassador at Large on modern-day slavery and current research professor in international studies at the Elliott School, George Washington University. He was a former chairman of the U.S. Senior Policy Operating Group on Trafficking of Persons and a U.S. congressman from Seattle for 4 terms. I'd like everyone to please rise and join me in welcoming our speaker.
Okay, good. Good.
Wow. You were the president, huh?
Vice president.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Vice President. Thank you for this warm welcome. It is my privilege to speak to such a distinguished group with such a noble heritage. I have been taken around by Michael this afternoon and Amro and colleagues this evening. I've heard a little about the Jefferson Society. And I know you like to really engage in discussion. So, I am not going to take up the whole time. I'm going to try to limit this to 30 or 40 minutes and leave plenty of time for questions. The subject that I'm here to address is one that when you go to Americans and say, what about slavery? They tend to say, didn't that end with the American Civil War? It's like slavery was in the past, or slavery was just in the United States, in the American South, and 1700s, 1800s. Well, first of all, slavery's been with us from time immemorial. The absence of slavery is the exception. But secondly, yes, slavery ended with the American Civil War in the United States, officially sanctioned slavery, legalized slavery. And if you look around the world, those official sanctions have ended everywhere. Most countries in the 19th century, following Britain and then the United States. As late as the 1970s, there were a couple of countries in the world that still legalized slavery, but Saudi Arabia abolished it in 1976, Mauritania in 1982. So there's no country that officially supports slavery. But slavery did not end with the American Civil War, did not end with legal abolition. Slavery has continued and now exists in every country of the world, including the United States of America. I say that based on the 4 years of work that I was privileged to do as U.S. ambassador, when I traveled around not only the United States, but the world. There may be an island paradise somewhere that doesn't have men, women, or children enslaved, but I never found it. Now, what kinds of slavery are we talking about? When slavery comes to mind in the United States, we think of blacks on plantations, race-based agricultural slavery in the past. The slavery we're talking about today, there's 4 or 5 kinds. It's maybe some relationship to race, ethnicity, but it's not primarily race-based. We're talking about bonded labor slavery that goes on for generations, that probably, if you count those in Pakistan and India, probably involves more people than any form of slavery in the world. We're talking about sex slavery, which is certainly the largest category of slavery in the so-called advanced countries. We're talking about domestic servitude slavery, biggest form of slavery in the Near East. We're talking, of course, about factory and farm slavery, although that's in smaller numbers than the kinds I've mentioned before. We're talking about child soldier slavery that goes on in places like Uganda and Sri Lanka. We're talking about slavery that affects millions of people. I was asked earlier, well, what do you estimate is the number? It's impossible to have a scientific estimate because slaves don't stand in line and raise their hands to be counted. But I think it's safe to say that if you count both the numbers trafficked across international borders and internal trafficking, there are millions in slavery today. Some scholars and NGOs put the figure as high as 27 million. And the vast majority of the victims are female. That should not be surprising, given that sex slavery and domestic servitude slavery are two of the largest categories. And probably up to half of those held in slavery today are children. They're under 18. Now, I've been talking categories and figures, but we're talking about a challenge that involves health, national security, human rights. We're talking about something that affects bodies and souls. So let me diverge for a moment and give you some specific stories of meetings with survivors. In my travels around the world, representing the U.S. government, gathering information for the State Department's annual report, pushing governments to do more, I probably met with over 1,000 survivors. I just want to tell you a few stories. Interestingly enough, not surprisingly, the first survivor story I'm going to tell you about was the first survivor I met. Naturally, that made an impression. Her name was Katja, and I met her at a hospital in Amsterdam, Holland. Katja was working in the hospital and taking a degree in social work, 29 years old. But when she was 18 or 19, Katja, who was Czech, was living in the Czech Republic with a 2-year-old daughter, a falling apart marriage, and a friend of the family that was no friend suggested to Katja, oh, you can get your life back in order, you can make some money, go to the Netherlands to work on tables in a restaurant. And Katja said, all right. The Czech trafficker drove Katja and several other young women and girls across Europe to Amsterdam, linked up with the Dutch trafficker. They took their passports away. It's a common technique. And then they drove Katja to a brothel in the Amsterdam Red Light District. How many people have seen the Amsterdam Red Light District? Looks like a place where everybody's having a good time. Women of all shapes and colors parading, smiling in windows. Katja was driven to a brothel and said, this is where you're going to be working. And she said, no, I came here to wait on tables. They said, no, you owe us X thousand euros. We brought you here. This is where you're going to be working. She said, no, I don't do this kind of work. And they said, yes, you will, if you want your two-year-old back in the Czech Republic to live. And so she did. Night after night, she wanted her two-year-old daughter, who then was four or five, to be with her. They said, all right, if you, quote, service 15 or 16 men a day instead of 11, you can earn enough to bring your daughter here. And so she did. Her daughter was brought over to the Netherlands. They found an apartment, 600 euros rent. She found out later it was 150. They took 450. And so every day, Katya, living in fear, would in the morning take her daughter to school, go back home to this apartment, sleep, then get up, take her daughter back from school, feed her, put her to bed, and then go to, quote, work, unquote. This went on for several years, and Katya was getting more and more depressed. She was on the verge of murdering her daughter and committing suicide. And one day she was in a taxi. She was not physically restrained. She was in fear, she was terrified, but she was not physically restrained. One day she was in a taxi, and the taxi driver was friendly, and she started blurting out what was happening. The taxi driver said, this is terrible, I'm going to do something. He did not go to the police. He went and he organized a gang of his friends. And they confronted Katya's traffickers and said, hand her over. And the trafficker said, and this was right in the red light district, the trafficker said, no, we own her. Hand her over. We'll hand her over, but you pay us 20,000 euros. We own her. They said, no, hand her over or you will suffer pain. Eventually, she was handed over with all sorts of conditions. Traffickers couldn't be revealed. One could say that Katya was lucky because she got out. And there she was in a hospital and studying for a degree in social work. But as she told the story, her eyes glazed over. I tell you Katya's story because it takes place in the Netherlands, an advanced country, a democracy, and it involves sex slavery. That same first trip, I was in Bangkok, Thailand, and I was visiting a shelter run by nuns, and I met Lord, who was at that time a teenage girl of maybe 15 or 16. Lord had been born in the Laotian Hill Country, probably when she was 10 or 11. She wasn't sure. Her parents had sold her, and then somebody had resold her. And eventually, from the Laotian Hill Country, she is delivered to an embroidery factory in Bangkok, where Lord, along with scores of other girls, 11, 12, 13, 14, work 14 hours a day sewing. In this place, they were physically restrained. Bars and locks, etc., they were not allowed out. No pay. They were given food and some clothing. Lord escaped because of a raid, government raid. But before she escaped, she had rebelled. They beat her, and she rebelled again. They threw her in a closet. And the owner's son put a BB gun to her cheek and fired. Then they dumped industrial chemicals on her. So after she escaped much surgery, plastic surgery, etc., I met her in the shelter. I must say, this is the positive aspect of this. You hear these gruesome things, but the power of human beings to recuperate is amazing. Because here was Lord, when she was called over to talk with me, she was laughing and playing with other girls. Let me give you one or two other examples, and I'll end up with one in the United States. When I was in Saudi Arabia about 2 years ago, I met with a young woman named Noor, an Indonesian woman, 27 years old. I met with her at a Starbucks in Riyadh. The reason I met with Noor is that Noor, like hundreds of thousands, millions of young women in South Asia, came to the Middle East to earn money as domestic servant, send money home. Some of this is very legitimate. Money is sent home by the millions and billions. And Lord actually had two previous trips to the Middle East. I think she had been a domestic servant in Jordan and Israel. It worked out very well. They came back a third time. It didn't work out so well a third time. She ended up in a home away from everybody, gated, working 15, 16 hours, 7 days a week, beaten, probably sexually abused, that's not clear. And Lord would never have been rescued. But with all the beatings, gangrene set in. Her owners didn't know what it was. But her owners looked on, Noor. Her owners looked on Noor as a commodity. So, like a TV set. The TV set doesn't work, you take it to the shop for repairs. Noor has a problem, health problem, we'll take her to the hospital for repairs. At the hospital, a nurse figured out something was wrong, realized that Noor was Indonesian, called the Indonesian embassy. Noor got out. Big trial, ended up with the wife of the slaveholder getting 37 lashes, the husband getting no punishment, and Noor being sentenced to 75 lashes. It was a case I discussed with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. It's after I met with her, things eventually were straightened out. But there's an example of domestic servitude, slavery. In Uganda, I met Nancy. Nancy was a young teenager working in a garden, kidnapped right out of the garden with her sister by the Lord's Resistance Army, forced to walk miles, trained to shoot and kill. I never asked her if they had made her come back and shoot and kill somebody in her family. I just couldn't do it. That's very common. She was held for several years, forced to live as a concubine. She tried to escape, was caught, beaten. The only reason that I met her in a Save the Children shelter is that in some battle, her jaw had been shot off by government soldiers, and she was left behind. She had been sent up to Italy for surgery. She was now in this shelter. Child soldier slavery. And last example, just so we know that it's, you know, this doesn't always happen in faraway places. I remember Vanita in Minneapolis, who had been taken in by a traffic or pimp, whatever you call this person, and basically terrorized for 8 or 10 years, forced to, against her will, to have sex. All the profits turned over to the pimp. She'd been branded, by the way. I mean, literally branded, pimp's name on her. And when I met her, she had been freed, but she was so unable to function, she couldn't even get on a bus alone. Now, these are just a few stories to put a human face on this, what we're talking about. Now, so what's going on here? What can be done? As I say, slavery has been going on since biblical times and before. Through Greece, Rome, the Middle Ages, the American South, South America, the transatlantic slave trade, right into the present day. A lot of the slavery today, while it's been going on continuously, I believe, I can't scientifically prove, I believe that it started increasing with globalization in the 70s and 80s. I believe that because travel increased. You don't find many slaves in their home villages. They've generally been transported to distant provinces or to other countries. And with globalization, there was more TV. I mean, this was, it's an aside, but when we talk about the causes of slavery, we always mention poverty, and of course it is a driving cause. But as I, the more I traveled, the more I came to conclude it was not just poverty, it was inequality of income. There was the push factor and the pull factor. What I mean by that, in Nigeria, they did a study to find out where did all the sex trafficking victims going to Italy come from? What villages? They expected it would show the poorest villages. What did it show? The villages with television. So that's why I say globalization is a part of this. You maybe you're forced, you're encouraged to leave by conditions, but there's an attraction at the other end. This isn't surprising, because many of the people in slavery are migrants. And if you look at who immigrated to the United States, the American, we could almost say it's, I think it borders on a myth that it was the abject poor who came here. Well, there were, of course, they were very poor people, but if you look more closely, it was not the poorest of the poor. Most of the people that came, they were poor all right, but they had the money to pay the shipping costs, to pay the recruiter. And they had ambition. They'd heard about the United States, freedom, gold coins, rolling in the street. They had that, there was that attraction. And so they came. Well, I think some of that is at work today with present-day slavery. Now, how do we address this? Clearly, there are some simple steps that need to be taken, and there are also some more complicated steps. But when we worked on evaluating countries around the world, we in the State Department, we talked about the three P's: prosecution, protection, and prevention. You have to have prosecution of the traffickers. If you don't have prosecution, the cycle doesn't end. I went out in the rural villages of India, and I met with bonded laborers, three generations, who had been freed. And here they had been given by the government a goat and 20,000 rupees, and they had a little hot. And I was feeling very good. I thought, isn't this wonderful? And then we looked a mile away, the rice mill, where they had been enslaved. It's still operating, the same owner. Did they ever prosecute? They never heard of a prosecution of a slaveholder. So, yes, these people are free. He just went back to his, quote, business. So there has to be prosecution of the traffickers if you're going to end the cycle. And this means arrests, it means convictions, it means sentences, it means punishment. It means taking the crime seriously. There are European countries, I'm sorry to say, that they've got wonderful arrest and prosecution records, but most of the, Germany for example, most of those convicted of trafficking get off on probation or suspended sentences. So you have to have law enforcement and prosecution. You have to have protection of victims. You have to care for the victims. You have to give them counseling. You have to give them medical care. They are victims of violence, and there are many shelters for women victims of violence, but there are some peculiar needs, particular needs of trafficking victims. And this requires tremendous efforts. And then there's prevention, there's education. I mean, it's not just education of potential victims, it's education of society. Sex trafficking doesn't happen without a market. The market is prostitution. The market may well be men who think that it's all, you know, recreation and there's no trafficking involved, even though the research shows around the world the vast majority of women and girls involved are not there because they're Julia Roberts. So education is a big thing. Now, I don't want to, I like to end on a positive, upbeat note. So let me tell you some good things that are happening that give hope. When the United States passed its Trafficking Victim Protection Act, there was just a handful of countries in the world that had comprehensive anti-trafficking legislation. Today, it's over 125 countries. That's between 2000 and now. 125 countries. That's not the be-all and end-all, passing a law, but it's a first step. If you look at convictions of traffickers, several years ago it was in the hundreds. Today, in the State Department report I gave AMRO, it's around 3,000. That's progress. If you look at shelters for victims, when I went around the world on that first tour, there were a couple hundred. Now, every month, another shelter is opening up. And that's progress. Education is where there's been the least progress. But there's a start of efforts there. Media awareness, increasing public knowledge, is a big part of education. And clearly, the news media references have been exponentially increasing. There's a problem with language in the news media sometimes. In the American South in the 19th century, the word slaves was used, but they also used words like houseboy and field hand. And today, instead of using the word slaves, words like forced laborers are used, or sex workers or child soldiers. It sort of anesthetizes it a little bit. But I think slowly as the news media gets deeper and deeper into this, education increases. So I see a positive trend there. Now, to just end where we began, it's a historical phenomena. It's been going on forever, but it shocks us that in the 21st century it's going on. And if you look back at the struggle against slavery in the United States, it took decades to end. The struggle in Britain. William Wilberforce, the British, anybody here heard of William Wilberforce? Good. Great hero. Started out in the British Parliament in 1787 with a proposal to outlaw the British slave trade. It was the only person. But 20 years later, the slave trade was outlawed. 20 years after that, slavery in the British Empire. Frederick Douglass in the United States. Harriet Beecher Stowe, Levi Coffin, they worked decades So this is a struggle that's going to take some time. It isn't going to happen overnight. But once people grasp what it is, in any country in the world, when people that have had the benefit of education like you have, when they hear about it and grasp, they say, this is terrible, we have to end it. So what we're at the beginning of is a 21st century abolitionist movement to finish the job that our ancestors started back in the 1800s. Let's throw it open to some questions. Fire away. Yes.
Thank you for coming. And I'm a history graduate student and I study the Civil War and Reconstruction.
All right.
And I'm interested in knowing if in your travels, what kind of culture, if any, exists among modern day slaves? And within these different groups, you mentioned the girl who rebelled.
Right.
Is that common? Do you find tight bonds, or is it different? Because at least in the experience of Civil War and Reconstruction, there was an intense culture for generations. And I'm curious if you find something in parallel.
That's a great question. It's the first time I've gotten that question. So it's the first time I've tried to answer it. Now, the difference is when slavery was legal in the American South, gruesome and terrible as it was, and denied education and denied religious training, slaves still did get together in groups. Okay. What we're talking about here, it was legal, okay? What we're talking about here, it's not like there's, you know, a million slaves in one area that can get together. So it's harder to define culture. Now, I think the closest, it's not similar because there's so many differences, but the closest I could come would be in India, where there is an untouchable caste. A quarter of India's population. When you read all about India, you read about the democracy, largest democracy in the world. It is the largest democracy in the world. You read about technology, rising middle class. They also have a quarter of the population that's in the untouchable caste. And when you look at who are the slaves, whether they are the bonded laborers or the sex slaves, they come from that class. But they don't gather as slaves. You see what I mean? But they are, in that sense, there is a label on that class. But in most countries, there isn't such a label. You can't say, well, there's that that caste or that group. Mauritania, there are subtle, there are overtones of racism. The white Arab slave traders who settled there and the dark Africans, it's been abolished, but there's all sorts of questions. Maybe there you could come close to a culture, but very, very hard. Somebody else, yeah.
Thank you for coming. You mentioned Noor in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And once it was actually brought to the attention of the officials, she actually got a worse punishment
than
offenders.
Yeah.
How do you deal with a government that has structures like that where the adversity is actually
Well, you do two things. First of all, you get on the phone to our ambassador and you say, this is outrageous, take us up with the Saudi government. Second, you go to Saudi Arabia, and when you get a meeting with the crown prince, you say, this is outrageous, do something about it. And third, in the report that evaluates countries and gives them tier ratings, you put a country like that in tier 3, which is the lowest tier, and it's an embarrassment to them, and it's a shame. It makes them eligible for sanctions, but the sanctions involve loss of aid, and they don't get practically any aid except educational and cultural assistance, which were reluctant to cut off educational exchanges. I would say that, and Saudi Arabia has a long way to go. I'm not going to defend what has happened in Saudi Arabia, but I would say that because of cases like Noor there and a whole series of meetings, for the first time, the people, the government are talking about the issues. I was interviewed by a Saudi Arabian reporter, and my interview appeared in the Saudi press, the English press, but in Saudi Arabia. There's the start. I can't cite, they're in tier three, which means they don't have a lot of 3P accomplishments, but there is the start of something there. There's the at least a discussion, a recognition that we, I hope, moving towards an end of denial of the problem. Yeah.
Thank you. My question is about education. You said that education was one of the main factors in dealing with human trafficking, and at the same time, one of the ones that's been getting the least attention Could you describe an education campaign that you thought was particularly successful, and then maybe make some recommendations?
Sure. I'll describe one campaign that I think shows signs of success. It was started by a woman named Norma Hotelling in San Francisco with an organization called SAGE. Norma Hotelling had been a trafficking victim, forced into prostitution. And she went to the authorities in San Francisco, the law enforcement, and she said, you know, you just keep arresting the women. But not only do you not arrest the pimps or the traffickers, if this is a crime under your law, why don't you arrest the customer? She convinced them to do that, but then Norma Hotelling thought, this isn't going to work by itself because the courts will never sentence the customer to jail. And so she said, don't, on the first offense, don't put the customer in jail, fine him $75 or $100 and send him to a school, which I will run. Now, I can tell you about this school because I visited it. In my suit and tie, I sat in the classes. And what it is, one day, not only law enforcement officials and psychologists and all that, but trafficking victims is the core part, so that the men understand that they are creating a market for women who are telling them about what it was like. Now, this program, there's a 2% recidivism rate. In other words, the men that have gone through it, only 2% are arrested again. Now, I want to be careful here, because there are lots of reasons there could be a low recidivism rate. It may not all be due to the course. It might be they're afraid of getting caught the second time and going to jail, which they've been warned about. It might be they've gotten more sophisticated about avoiding the law, et cetera. You can never draw up. But the results seem very promising. In 15 cities, approximately, similar programs have been started. They're not all as successful. There's one in D.C., I hear it is not as successful, but this seems to offer some hope. Now, that's in the sex trafficking area, and I've talked about that program as I went around the world. There are very few examples like that in other countries. In fact, I can't think of any. But let's take another area of trafficking. That's sex trafficking. Let's look at factory worker trafficking. I think there, we were talking at dinner about a case in Jordan involving textile factories owned by, in a free trade zone, owned by foreign businessmen, maybe mainly from Asia, but selling the products eventually reaching American manufacturers, or pig iron in Brazil, charcoal in Brazil, lot of slave labor involved in charcoal, and the charcoal, Bloomberg News had a story, it eventually ended up in automobiles, Ford automobiles. I think that kind of, those kind of cases suggest education. And education of business companies, that they have to be responsible not just for their own workers, but they have to look back along the chain where those workers came from and the products involved. That's not easy. I'm the first to admit that. But that kind of education would be very helpful. And there's other kinds of education that we could do. Education of police. I mean, the police have basically approached sex trafficking in this country and many other countries as a nuisance manifesting itself as prostitution, where we're just going to pick on the women. Now, education of the police. You have a country like Sweden, for example, that has, I find this a very interesting experiment. It's not strictly speaking educational, but it has educational significance. Sweden decriminalized the conduct of women engaged in prostitution, but criminalized the conduct not only of the pimp, the trafficker, and the brothel owner, but the customer. Amazing thing happened. This was using the law as an educational device. An amazing thing happened. I'm not saying trafficking was eliminated in Sweden. I'm not suggesting prostitution was eliminated. But an amazing thing, there's no doubt, the number of trafficking victims going into Sweden has dropped dramatically. We see the intelligence reports and all this. So there are ways to address this problem. Something like child soldier slavery, I don't know how you address that. I mean, when there are terrorists that abduct people, I mean, they're a little beyond education. So I can't say education is the answer for everything. Somebody else, yeah. Go ahead, yeah.
Thank you for the two questions. Firstly, how can we address issues such as prostitution when the current American culture tends to excite sexual?
Yeah.
Based on a lot of news that I've read, yeah, in Chinese, the factory owners in China have to resort to slave labor because the U.S. multinationals offer such a low price to them that they have to use some kind of illegal method. So my question is, how can we solve this problem if, as Americans, we continue this blockage pattern?
Yeah. Well, I think a comment on Chinese slave labor. I think we have to distinguish poor working conditions from slavery. It's very tempting to, you know, I would get reports, oh, they're working too many hours, they're not getting enough pay. We want to see pay increased and we want to see working conditions better. But everybody that's in a poor working condition is not a slave. So there's something so heinous that I think it's justified in focusing the effort on slavery. Now let's get to the culture issue. I think it's very difficult to keep people from buying products at a low price. I mean, that's, however, one can pressure China. I was in China raising this issue with the government. I'm not saying very successfully. They're very prickly. But you can keep pushing them. You can keep pushing them. And you can put the pressure on American corporations. I think the pressure is not to just pay more. In a market economy, you can't say, not knowing where the good came, we'll just pay more. But I think you can say, we're going to hold you responsible for where the good came from. If we find out that you're getting goods from a slave factory, we're going to publicize this. Let me tell you, American companies don't like that publicized. When this story came out on Bloomberg about the charcoal, the pig iron going to, oh my gosh, Ford Motor Company was sending people down to Brazil. When this came out on the textile companies in Jordan, did I mention that? I can't remember. I mentioned it at dinner. I sent letters to all the American clothing manufacturers. They hadn't hired the workers in Jordan. They didn't own the businesses, but ultimately they were the purchasers. And I said, you know, you have to put the pressure on or else we're going to publicize this. I found them very responsive. I mean, it's they, because those same consumers that you talk about, those same consumers, yes, they want to get good products at a low price, but the typical American consumer is shocked by slavery. And if they feel that Ford Motor Company isn't doing something about this, or Hershey isn't doing something about the cocoa farmers in West Africa, which Hershey is, by the way, now, they're going to do something. And so I think that's how you address it. Now, the sex trafficking, the sex part of culture, is much tougher. We have free speech issues. We have all this. I think, however, you see some, maybe I'm being Pollyannish here, but I see some positive signs. On the one hand, I see Hollywood giving an Academy Award to a song that glorifies pimping. That happened last year. I mean, that's true. So I'll start off with something that isn't so good if you talk about the culture. But on the other hand, if I look over the last 10 or 20 years, while Hollywood maybe in their awards has not caught up with this issue, I do see more awareness, not just in the United States, but elsewhere, of the link between prostitution and sex trafficking. This was not publicized until recently. I remember going to a conference my first year as ambassador at large. The deputy prime minister of Sweden was there, and she made a statement that was so obvious, but it stunned people. She said, who are we kidding? Who are we kidding if we don't think prostitution is a contributing phenomenon to sex trafficking? I mean, well, you have to make people know. The fact that Norma Helteling's course seems to be successful, and I looked at the people in the room, there was a shock. I don't think everybody constituting that market, all the consumers, understand some of the factors that they don't see. So I'm not saying it isn't a huge problem. I'm not saying it's going to be solved tomorrow, but I see some positive signs. Yes?
I wanted to ask you, we mentioned at dinner the sort of Nevada situation and how the sexual trade is legalized there, and you mentioned a study in which you saw sort of a commensurate amount of sort of trafficked individuals that were part of the sex trade there. I was wondering if you can comment on the legality of it and whether the culture of sex trafficking.
Well, this comes up. It's a sub-issue that's debated. Does one help reduce sex trafficking by legalizing and regulating prostitution or making it illegal? I have to say that in my experience, well, clearly there are many countries where it's illegal and there's still sex trafficking due to corruption and other things. But I have to say, when I looked at the countries where they legalized and regulated, it didn't seem to have any positive effect. It seemed to have a negative effect. The illegal trafficking increased, probably because if you have a legalized sex trade, you're creating a magnet for victims. Now, this study in Nevada showed, Nevada is not all legal. 10 counties are legal, the rest is illegal. But the study, in essence, showed there doesn't seem to be any difference. That in terms of trafficking victims, they occur in both. The author visits, again, it's not, one can say, well, this isn't scientific because not all the women she talked to could talk freely. But she has pictures of brothels in counties where it's legal, where there are bars and barbed wire fences around the brothels. Now, I mean, that gives you a tip-off. Personally, on this legal versus illegal, I like the Swedish model. I think decriminalizing for the women and prosecuting not only the traffickers, the pimps, the brothel owners, but the Johns, that to me shows the most results in terms of affecting the culture. If you had that coupled with the Norma Hoteling type programs, that to me is would be my preferred solution. The United States has traditionally just been, it's been illegal with a lot of discriminatory prosecution. But we are starting to move towards the Swedish model, slowly. The Congress passed legislation about 2 years ago, which President Bush signed, that gives the Attorney General authority to make grants to local law enforcement to encourage them to be non-discriminatory in their prosecutions, which and prostitution, which means prosecuting the men. And it also provides grants for, authorizes grants for Norma Hoteling type programs. Of course, Congress, like a lot of measures Congress passes, it's the authorization is great, but the appropriation bill that delivers the money hasn't happened yet. But I think that's, and I see in local law enforcement in the United States, I see signs of change, a more sophisticated approach, a less discriminatory approach. I think we're starting to move towards the Swedish model. Yeah.
I was wondering, in your travels, whether you've noticed that the values that oppose slavery are universal.
Yeah.
And whether you think, you know, in a world without the Anglo-American,
yeah,
Well,
that's a good question. As I said, slavery's been with us in every continent from time immemorial. So it doesn't, globalization may have increased it in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years, but it's been there in every country, which says something about greed and attitudes that human beings have. Nonetheless, going back to what I said at the beginning, even though there may be less action in some countries, even though there may be denial in other countries, there was certainly denial in Saudi Arabia. I found denial in India among government officials, not the NGO community, on the bonded labor problem. There is certainly an acceptance of the fact that slavery is wrong. I mean, all these countries have signed numerous anti-slavery conventions. I mean, there's a UN protocol. I mean, it's true. It's a symbolic document.
Yeah, you told us about the economic challenges.
Yeah.
I'm
sorry, I didn't understand.
You're saying that if you don't sign such
things, well, if you don't take measures, it's not signing a protocol. That's just a symbolic act. The ratings are based on on actions and prosecution, protection, and prevention. But I was saying, in terms of showing cultural attitudes, even though this UN protocol is not enforceable, you know, it gets down to national will, the fact that all these countries sign it shows at least a cultural recognition on the part of the educated governing classes that slavery is wrong. I could find people denying, when I travel around the world, I find people denying that it exists in their country, or not taking aggressive prosecution steps, or not caring for victims. But I didn't find anybody saying, oh, this is, in our country, slavery is acceptable. It's culturally acceptable. It's just not the case. So there is a universal value. It is true, you can say the abolitionist movement started in England with Wilberforce and all this, but at this point today, I think those minimal values are accepted around the world.
Thank you very much for your informative presentation. My question was, to what extent do you witness border laws among countries in Eastern Europe or in South Asia as having a role to play in it?
Okay.
And if it does play a role, what are some things that can be done to make sure that kind of control?
Yeah. They play a role. Of course, after the Soviet Union disintegrated and the European Union was formed, where people could travel from one country to another, that led to ease of travel. It was part of globalization, and it probably facilitated trafficking. There's no question that border enforcement can have a positive effect, but I really caution on this. Do not conflate illegal alien smuggling with trafficking. There may be an illegal alien may be smuggled in who is a trafficking victim, but it is not a one-on-one situation. My impression around the world and in the United States is that most of the victims of trafficking that came across borders came in legally. They may have, may not stayed legal. When I was considering taking this job, front page of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, U.S. attorney indicts 8 in Seattle in sex slavery ring. 14 girls freed. The 14 girls had been brought into the country, illegally. I'm sure, you know, they had the proper visas, they had this, of course. There was some deception in giving the purposes of the visa. But once they got into the country, they're locked up. They're shifted from Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles. So it's there needs to be scrutiny at the borders. But that's not the only problem. I mean, the women, Noor, going to the Middle East, she goes legally. She's not an illegal immigrant. Indonesia wants her to go, and Saudi Arabia wants her to come. I do want to go ahead. Somebody else have a question or comment? I was going to say, we're probably getting near the end here, but we got more time. I was going to say, if you look at what can be done, I've talked about government's role, NGOs, businesses, individuals can do something. An individual can look at what's going on in his or her community. Is there a non-governmental organization providing help for victims? What is the police attitude? Are they scrutinizing trafficking? Talking to the police? Individual can go to their church or civic group, say, well, can we give some help either in this country or abroad on this issue? Can our state legislature pass an anti-trafficking law? It's a federal crime. It's only in the last couple of years states have started passing laws. There's some question about the the efficacy of those laws, but assuming they are tough laws, bringing state and local law enforcement to the table is a good thing to do. So there's a role for individuals as well as businesses and NGOs and governments. Somebody else. Oh, my God. Any country in the world you want to ask about. I may not have the answer, but you can ask. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there have been some police raids. It's interesting in India. NGOs recognize the problem, non-governmental organizations, and they have a tremendous civil society in India, in my opinion. Government officials, I found, very defensive and bureaucratic, and it was interesting where they were defensive and where they weren't. They were willing to discuss the problem of sex slavery because, I could say, we share this problem. And they knew every country in the world has sex slavery. So they would talk about that. But if you got into bonded labor, I mean, I couldn't say in the United States we have a huge bonded labor problem. They were very sensitive because they know it's a peculiar problem of the Indian subcontinent. And so I would meet with officials and I would say, you know, there are International Labor Organization reports, there's your own Human Rights Commission that reports thousands of these laborers, and I'd have the number two or three person labor department say, it's just not true, it doesn't exist. And the next day I'd go out to near Chennai and I'd meet with the victims that I talked to you about. And meet with provincial officials who would say, oh, we rescued 700,000 victims last year, when the federal official had told me the problem doesn't exist. Now, this is, they have a good law. As I said, they have a law that gives compensation all to the victims. There isn't yet a willingness to go after the perpetrators. And I hope it will come. I think there are Indian groups that are pushing the government. They don't like, in this report, they're on tier two watch list, which is just above tier three. In my opinion, they should be in tier three, but they're on tier two watch list. And they didn't like it. Every time when the report came out, they denounced it. But that's all right, because the 2 days after the report came out, there were editorials in the major papers in India. And interestingly enough, the editorials were sympathetic with the report. I thought they were going to beat up on the U.S., but they didn't. They said, this is a major problem. We all know this. You know, the government has to do something. So I have some hope there. Yeah.
How much does this economically play in some countries? Like, wow, it wouldn't be a huge economic helper to, like, kind of like India, but like some of these smaller countries. Does it help the economy in these countries?
Well, you know, I mean, this has been argued for hundreds, for centuries. Thomas Dew back in, he was a Virginian. Anybody know Thomas Dew? Yeah. Back in 1830, argued, well, the slavery was essential for the economy, among other arguments. I don't believe, and I haven't seen economic studies on this, but I just, when I see what's involved, I don't really believe it's a major part of anybody's economy. I mean, I can't find one major industry of a country that's predominantly, where the labor is predominantly slave. The example that's often cited is the cocoa growing in West Africa. It's not predominantly slave-grown cocoa. There is slave-grown cocoa, but there's 600,000 private farmers. They're not all using slaves. So that cocoa would get grown. I mean, it's somebody might lose something, but I don't think if you're talking in terms of a major part of an economy, I don't see it. Yeah, let me just make sure nobody else is. Go ahead.
With respect to law enforcement, I know this is going to sound obvious because it's in the U.S. Constitution, but where does the 13th Amendment play into local law enforcement?
Oh, that's a good question. When the 13th Amendment abolishing or prohibiting slavery, when Congress passed the anti-trafficking law in 2000, if you look at the preamble, there's a reference to the Kosminski case in the 1980s, where the Supreme Court took a very narrow interpretation of the 13th Amendment in terms of how you show that there's slavery. It's a moral force. I mean, it influences people. It influences the passage of this law. I haven't seen, if you mean, are there prosecutions based on the 13th Amendment? Not that I know of. We have somebody who worked with the Justice Department last summer here. Who is it? Yes. Did they use the 13th Amendment?
No, most of the statutes they would use were local prosecution statutes.
Yep, yep. I mean, so I don't think it's used as a tool, but this isn't to say that it's not a powerful provision. Yeah. Well, I think the religious groups have played a, just like in the 19th century, the abolitionist movement that Wilberforce started was primarily evangelicals and Quakers, and then in the United States, the churches and the Underground Railroad. I think religious groups have played a major role. The U.S. law was passed primarily with the support of religious and feminist groups. That was an interesting coalition, right? The religious groups were on the front lines around the world. They were running shelters and seeing these people come in. So they got involved very early on. The feminist groups that were more advocacy groups got involved for the obvious reason they started recognizing that this is the women's emancipation issue of our day. The victims are female. So right now there's a powerful coalition of primarily faith-based but some feminist groups. I mean, a coalition ranging from the Salvation Army and Concerned Women of America to Equality Now and Coalition Against Trafficking Women that is trying to toughen the law in Congress. And I felt as ambassador, one of my jobs was to help build that coalition, build bipartisan support, build support from religious groups. So it's a very significant role. That isn't to say they can't do more. I mean, every government can do more. Every society can do more. There isn't a country. You know, the interesting thing about these State Department evaluations, they have tier one is the best tier, minimum standards, the minimum standards. Every country, every government can do more. Every society can do more, including the United States. Yes?
I'm wondering a bit about your experience with and your perspective on NGO culture in some of the developing countries that you've been to. You mentioned NGOs, and I'm assuming there are many that you've worked with that are specifically focused on trafficking. But is there, to your knowledge, or do you have examples of collaboration between NGOs, maybe some organizations that are working on the deeper, more structural poverty issues, and some that are collaborating with ones that are focused more on trafficking, sort of across the
scenario? Cross-disciplinary sounds great. But I got to tell you, I can't think of a ready example. There aren't that many NGOs working on it. It's been increasing, the number, working on trafficking. It's hard to work on it. Well, I would say an NGO that tries to reintegrate a victim, survivor, into a community and give them a job is working, you could say, on both. An organization like Hagar in Cambodia It was started by a Swiss businessman with some church support from Switzerland. He started a shelter, then he started giving them care, then he realized they needed medical attention, then he realized they needed education, then he realized they needed a job. There were no jobs in Cambodia. And he, this guy is brilliant. Unfortunately, I don't know how you replicate this. He came up with ideas for businesses to just employ trafficking victims, a soy milk company to sell soy milk all over Cambodia, Hagar handbag design. There are some high-end department stores that have their handbags, but mostly in Japan, some here. A janitorial service, a catering service. He was bringing in scientists from Israel to set up a grapefruit business. I mean, so you could say that's cross-discipline. Of course, my colleagues in the Department of Labor said, oh, we'll give grants, we'll duplicate this. Listen, I mean, I was wowed by what this man did, Pierre Tommy. But I said, well, how are you so successful? He said, a lot of thought and a lot of marketing. I mean, it's not just something you can just say, oh, it worked there, so let's, you know, spread it everywhere. Although I've got the World Bank conducting some kind of experiment to see if it can be replicated. We'll see. Yeah. Sure. I could give you the legal definitions and all that, but actually, when you're talking about slavery, somebody has been coerced either physically or mentally or emotionally into doing something they don't want to do and they don't have the freedom to leave. Now, you can get into all sorts of fine distinctions, but basically that's what it is. It is the antithesis of freedom. Now, here's what amazes me, and I can't remember if I've said this, stop me if I've said this, because we were talking, and you know, I think I mentioned this to Michael. You would think, here's where we can all do better. You would think that slavery would be a major human rights issue, right? The opposite of freedom. How can there be anything more basic than that? If you look at human rights organizations in this country, some of them get involved. As I said, it was mainly religious groups and feminist groups. It's not high on their agenda. And I'm going to name one. Anybody here heard of Freedom House? Okay, Freedom House has a very distinguished history, as you know. Freedom House led the fight against fascism and communism and has this Freedom Index they put out every year. They rate countries how free they are. Guess what? The word slavery, at least in their last report that I read, was not mentioned once. What governments were doing against slavery is not mentioned. Political and civil rights violations are covered extensively. So I think along with governments doing more, individuals doing more, human rights organizations can do more. This to me, why does this happen? I have an explanation. Victims of religious or political persecution. Our hearts go out, but they tend to be articulate, at least compared to the victims of slavery. The bonded laborers I met in India, Noor, who I met in Saudi Arabia, Katja, who I met in the Netherlands, Vanita in Minneapolis, they're not articulate. They can't stand up and give press conferences. So there's a challenge here for organizations that are concerned with human rights to recognize this is a major human rights issue. Yeah.
John, you've taken us through a wide variety of topics, very powerful speech. I'd just like to ask one final question.
Yep.
How optimistic are you about our nation, our world's efforts to eradicate slavery?
Well, I tried to paint both sides of the picture, right? I didn't want to cover up the gruesome details, but as I said, there is growing news media coverage, there is a growing number of convictions, there is a growing number of shelters, etc., etc. So I think, as I said, it isn't going to happen overnight, but we are starting to move in the right direction. People say, well, are there more slaves or less slaves than 2 years ago? Well, of course, how can I answer that? Because there's no census count. I believe slavery was increasing, as I said, in the 70s, 80s, 90s. I believe, or at least I like to believe, that a corner has been turned, because if there are more shelters, and if there are more prosecutions, and if there are more convictions, if there are, there's more publicity, this, you know, logic tells me this must have some positive effect. So I think we're starting in the right direction. Unfortunately, as I said, there's so much more to be done. If we are going to finish the job that our ancestors back in the 1800s started. And I like to believe, as I said, it's universal issue and universal values, but let's face it, we've suffered the stain of slavery in this country. So we are more aware of, we're more sensitive, and we should be. And I do believe there's a role for the United States to play on this issue, and it's a role we should play. Thank you all. Good. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.